Welcome to Move Wild Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Clapson. The aim of this podcast is to explore, learn, and spread the message of rewilding and natural movement so that we as humans can live in more alignment with our nature and reclaim what it means to be fully alive. The modern world has stripped away so much that used to nourish our mind, body, and soul. This podcast will help illuminate how we can reclaim and restore our innate, wild, capable, and strong spirit. Thanks for joining me on this journey. Welcome back to another episode of Move Wild Podcast. I hope you're all well and are ready to jump into this episode. So today I have the pleasure of sharing a conversation that I recorded with Lee True of Blue Gum Bushcraft. So Lee taught bushcraft and coyote mentoring on youth camps before training as a psychotherapist and counselor. Lee has been using John Young's coyote mentoring approach for over a decade and began learning and teaching bushcraft as a teenager at the forest school camps in the UK. He studied indigenous survival skills at Tom Brown Jr.'s Tracker School and Practical Primitive both in the US and spent a year living in the bush, finding shelter, water and food on the landscape, putting it into practice. More than that, he found a radically new experience of what it means to be human. Now he brings psychology and bushcraft together for rewilding, helping people of all ages to reawaken their wildness and deepen their connection with the natural world. He was also a speaker on rewilding at the Ultimate Health event in Sydney, featured in ABC's Life at Nine documentary, an instructor for Claire Dunn during the period she wrote about in her book My Year Without Matches, and the bushcraft and trapping consultant for Australian film The Hunter. So Lee is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to these things. We got into a whole different range of topics. I really enjoyed this conversation, really connected with Lee, and it's one that I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys think of. So let's jump into this episode with Lee True, and catch me on the other side for how you can connect with Lee and how you can connect with me.
Awesome. Yeah, that's recording. So thanks for coming on, Lee. I really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
So I'm really interested. You've done a lot of work with teenage rites of passage. And could you talk to us a little bit about rites of passage and maybe the importance of rites of passage in the modern world and kind of how you got into that work specifically?
There's a lot there. There's a lot we could talk about. The way I approach rites of passage is, I think it's almost like a second birth. You know, the first birth, when kids come out into the world, they're separating from mum physically. I was actually literally a part of your body, and now I'm out in the world and I'm running around. And that rite of passage, moving through the birth canal, there's all kinds of processes and patterns and knowledge and challenges that go with that. And then a similar thing starts happening around teenagehood, starts happening before that actually, and I think that there's a sort of a mini one that happens around 7 or 8 often, where they call it the rite of competence, where kids at that age are realizing, hey, I'm not one of those babies anymore. I know how to do stuff. I can put my own clothes on and tie a shoelace. And in primitive cultures, around 8 was the time when kids were first starting to go out on hunts as well. It's like I can light fire by this time. I can use edged tools. I can even start to provide food for the tribe. But then around teenhood, that's where in tribal societies, I'm really looking at full adulthood. I might by that point have a wife already. I might have kids that I need to support or have kids on the way. And in our culture, what we see is that kids at that age start to get this really strong sense of autonomy, or just a need for autonomy. And my sensitivity around my need for autonomy becomes hair trigger. So it's really easy for me to feel patronized by my parents, for instance. Really easy for me to feel like parents are just kind of these cringy, annoying nobodies that I have to get away from in a hurry. And we see, especially with boys, part of what happens in that part of that process is acting in really antisocial, vicious, or even violent ways towards parents, trying to get themselves kicked out of the nest. It's like there's an instinctive, I need to get away from you. I need to create a sense of self that's independent from my family. And the separation here, you know, previously the separation was a physical separation from mum and dad. Now it's a separation from an emotional and psychological separation. I need to have a sense of self that isn't dependent on you guys telling me who I am. And if I don't get that distance, things get really ugly. I'm going to get vicious. I'm going to try and make that distance happen in a really unskillful and destructive way, because there's a part of me that senses my survival as an adult depends on this. I need to separate. I need to individuate. They call it in psychological terms. And if I don't, some people don't individuate, and then you see these crushed man children living in the basements, in their parents' basements, and they haven't managed to leave the nest.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's so interesting. And it seems to be so lacking, that idea of rites of passage in the modern world. Like, why do you think that we've kind of lost a ritualized sense of rites of passage?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think one of the big gaps that we have at the moment is we don't really have many ways for kids and teens to contribute in a meaningful way to society. And what has become a meaningful way to contribute to society, making money and being able to hold down a job and those kinds of things, requires really narrow, quite often abstract and symbolic skills. What that means is that teenage brains, which can be physically quite intelligent, can be quite intuitive, but don't really have the patience for sitting down and being able to read reports and write them and do office work. They aren't really suited for that. And so in our culture, what we see is you can go into a trade, and that's a one option, that's a viable option. But if you don't do that, if you don't have physical means of work, you're basically just a sort of a parasite. We're just going to try and push you to the side, and you might find some esteem, some self-esteem and some skill in the online world. But other than that, you're just in a sort of a holding pattern with a whole bunch of free time and probably even free resources. And things can get really bad because we're not giving you any way to sort of have a place in our tribe and show what your skills are, show what your qualities are, and be respected for that. You just got to hang out until your brain settles down enough that you're going to be useful for office work, and then you can come into the world. And then suddenly we can ask you, from having been just a nothing, just a sort of a by-the-by person in your family household, just suddenly we need you to accelerate your skills and contribute to the world. And a lot of 20-somethings really struggle with that, because it's like, hang on, I had no responsibility whatsoever, and now suddenly I'm an intern and people are asking me to do this adulting thing. I don't really know what it is, because there's not much of a smooth track into that often.
Yeah, interesting. And you mentioned like having a feeling like we need a sense that we are contributing to a community, and that seems more and more as our communities become more and more it's so hard to connect to this global community, or this community that's not, we don't really feel in touch in the modern world. And I imagine in Indigenous societies, we would have had a very visceral experience of like, oh, I'm contributing to my community, and I can actually see the impact of that.
Yeah. I mean, in any like environment where there are kids of different ages and there are, and we know each other and we're kind of invested in each other, then as soon as I'm strong enough to pick up a smaller child, I'm kind of a mentor for that child. So there's like 5-year-olds carrying 1-year-olds around and being appreciated for that, being respected for that, getting opportunities to learn about how to be a good mentor and pass on the kind of role modeling that they received as well. So yeah, right from the get-go, if we live in mixed age groups where we're strongly invested in each other and where we have the ability to make a meaningful difference in each other's lives, that kind of transition is smooth and effortless and invisible. And when we live in nuclear isolated families where a lot of the work that we're being asked to do is symbolic and alienated from my needs and my values, and is a disembodied role, then it's very hard to get young people to contribute in a meaningful way.
Yeah, Can you
and to get excited about.
Absolutely, yeah. Can you just speak to that a little bit more, that idea of it being a disembodied roller? I think I know what you're getting at, but what's the difference between, you know, like more, I guess, traditional ways of living where we have embodied role, and what's the now modern, like this disembodied role that you talk about?
Yeah, what I mean is, if I'm living in a tribal culture, or in a culture that's really earth-based, then when I'm hungry, I go find food. When I'm tired, I sleep. If I'm cold, I put something on the fire. Our physical needs can be met in a direct and immediate way. Whereas in a city, I meet my physical needs in a quite roundabout way. I've got to put on strange clothes. I've got to know how to talk a certain language. I've got to interact with computers and pieces of paper and shuffle stuff around on a desk in order to get some digits put into this imaginary thing called a bank account. And then I can draw out these bits of paper that we have agreed are going to have meaning. And then I can get my food, and then I can get electricity and get heat and warmth and those kinds of things. It's just a roundabout way of doing it.
Yeah, it's a very abstract, strange system.
Yeah.
So I'd like to backtrack a bit and go into kind of your backstory and how you got into this whole world of rewilding and primitive skills and rites of passage and men's work and all of that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, but before we move on, there's one thing I wanted to say just to parents about rites of passage stuff, which is that in all of the indigenous cultures that I've seen, there's an understanding that parents are incapable of giving their kids the kind of distance that they need when they reach that rite of passage age. It's just unreasonable to ask mums to be able to let their sons go or let their daughters go. And so that's why in all of those cultures, aunties and uncles would do that job. They would come along and they'd say, hey, mom, dad, it's time to let your kid grow up. It's time to let go of your child so that they can symbolically die to you and come back as a young adult. But we know that you're incapable of doing that. It's unfair to ask you to let go in that way because you just love them too much. So we're going to take them away. And often there was a sort of a ceremony around that where parents would try and hold on to their kids, and then the aunties and uncles would take them away, even if there was a bit of a struggle involved. I just think it's important for parents to know it's hard for you to do that work that a whole village is supposed to do, and you're not supposed to. So if you feel like you're struggling and it's hard to give your kids that space, there's a good reason for that.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I'm curious, just quickly, like how do we recreate that in the modern world? Like, how do we recreate the aunties and uncles and that role coming in? You know, if they feel like they want a rite of passage and they feel that they can't get that with their parent, or the parent is listening and they feel like they want to create a teenager.
Yeah, I mean, the ideal is if you've got some people in your child's life, like literal aunties and uncles or good friends who can spend time with them out bush, and you can say to them, hey, so-and-so is going to take you camping for the weekend, or so-and-so is going to come around and have dinner and I'm going to go out for the evening. But then there's also more formal, more structured ways where, you know, on our programs, I was working with the Pathways Foundation where we run rites of passage, and there'd be a group of us, and we were symbolically the uncles. And on our family camps, our Rewild tribe family camps, we have a whole team of mentors whose only job is to be emotionally available aunties and uncles.
Yeah, that's awesome.
To fulfill that role. Because, I mean, in a nuclear family, there's just not enough strands to make a proper basket, to make the kind of basket that can support a process like rites of passage or like deep nature connection, or anything really. In a nuclear family, is really just mum or dad. So all it takes is for like mum to have a crap day, dad hasn't had much sleep, or he's got a headache, and now the whole basket's just falling apart. Now there's no kind of safety and no kind of emotional availability.
Yeah.
My experience as a kid, maybe we'll get into this, but as a kid on the forest school camps, it was a revelation to me to realize, whoa, here are all of these adults. There's just an abundance of acceptance. There's an abundance of attention. There's an abundance of respect. And it's okay for someone to be having a crap day and go have a lie down. The whole thing doesn't come crashing down. There's a real safety and solidity to just the sheer number of people out here, which is so different to a nuclear family.
Yeah, I love that. And I'd love to go into the camps and the programs that you run at some point as well. But let's go back and, yeah, and share a little bit about your journey and how you got into all of this.
Sure.
So yeah, yeah.
You want me to just start talking?
Yeah, just start talking. What inspired you? What are some of the, you know, things that got you on this path?
Yeah, well, I was the first child to a couple of really quite young and out of their depth parents, and I was living in a tower block till I was 4 years old. And all my memories then, looking back now, I don't know if it's maybe it's just a filter I put on there, but the memories seem to be kind of black and white then. I don't really remember playing with any other kids. I do remember lots of kind of long moments of silence and watching cars go by. And then when I was four and my sister was about to be born, we moved into this really unusual situation in London where five houses had knocked down their garden fences. And because they knocked down their garden fences, they had about an acre of land between them. And there was just five different families. The kids from five different families were running around as a pack, and there were apple trees, and there was a fruit, there was a veggie patch, and there was free range guinea pigs. And I remember as a 4 year old entering into that world, and it was just like, it was like Neverland. You know, it's just a paradise suddenly. There's older kids who know all these cool games and are interested in teaching them to me. And there's younger kids here who I can show them stuff that I've discovered. And there's always fun things happening, just this sort of spontaneous, amazing, magical play where each day we didn't know really what was going to happen, but there was faith that if we just turn up, cool things are going to happen, because they have happened every other day before then. And that kind of magical sense of running with a pack, and then there also being more than enough aunties and uncles, you know, other adults around who are interested in me and invested in me at some level. That's the feeling that I've sort of tried to recreate on our family camps. And then after that, moving to to that house with those kids, a bit later as a teen, a lot of those kids had moved away. And again, I was feeling a bit isolated, and I was going to high school in London, and school was fairly rough. If you looked at the wrong person for too long, you might have to fight them or get beaten up outside of school later on. And at that time, I discovered the forest school camps, and that was sort of like a whole nother level of having this village feel, because on the forest school camps, there would be 100 people in the field, 120 people in the field. And this feeling of a tribe or a village that was bigger than any one individual, that had its own robustness and momentum and a sort of a zeitgeist and intelligence that was bigger than any one individual. And the feeling of that was felt so safe and energizing to me. It's like, wow, this is so inspiring and so safe and felt so natural and good. And I had this feeling one of the nights we used to sit in a circle around the campfire and eat dinner together, looking around the circle and thinking, I knew there was another way to live. I knew there was another way to live. And this is fucking it. And now I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to recreate this for me, because I'm hooked. I don't want anything else now. Nothing else really compares to this.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what happened from there? Where did you go from there?
So then next I went to uni, and I did a study abroad year and got to go to the States, and went to Tom Brown's Tracker School, did the Kamana Naturalist program with John Young. And actually, I found out about Tom's school because as a forest school camp staff member, we'd realized actually this organization does social technologies really well, that the whole village culture is great, but we don't know that much survival stuff or that much bushcraft. So let's learn some more. And we found this guy who was a student of Tom's, and it was really great learning those skills, knowing I was going to teach them, knowing I had a village to bring them back to. I think it really accelerated my learning and sort of made it really meaningful, made it really easy to listen and pay good attention and feel inspired. Then I got to, in my year in the States, I did as many programs with Tom as I could. And over the next few years, I was going back and forth. I'd go for a few months at a time, take a whole bunch of of his courses, and then come back and get to teach them and put them into practice straight away. And after a few years of that, I did my year in the bush, in the Pine Barrens. There, they let you, four people at a time, can just live it for a year. So that's what I got to do. And that after that, I met an...
That would have been an epic. Share a little bit, like, how that year in the bush was.
It was an epic experience. At the time, a lot of the time, I just thought I must be doing it wrong, because I'd read stories, you know, about people spending time in the bush, and there was all kinds of incredible spiritual experiences or feelings of oneness or flow. And a lot of the time, especially after the first three months, it was like, great, amazing. Every day was an adventure. I was filled with inspiration. And then after those first few months, turbulent emotions started coming up. It was almost like my internal Pandora's box just got opened, and the kind of consequences of growing up in a nuclear family that felt really unsafe, and then going to a high school that felt almost like a prison, and there was, you know, violence and stuff, and then just sort of like growing up in a city, I realized, and having, I think, quite a sensitive nervous system that sort of tends towards being anxious and feeling a bit unsafe, all of this stuff just started to pour out, and I'd be suddenly overwhelmed with terror or rage or grief, shame, or sort of memories of things that I'd done and said that had hurt other people came back and haunted me, or things that other people had done to me. And at the time, I thought I was just losing my mind, or, you know, I'm just in a bad headspace. I need to sort of focus and get back in the game somehow. But looking back, I actually think it was just a detox process. And it was like my body, my organism was just releasing all of the sort of undigested emotional and psychological experiences that it had and was now saw, okay, here's an opportunity to release them. And there was no distraction. I couldn't just talk to friends. I couldn't surf the internet. I couldn't get lost in Netflix. There was no running away from myself. And so for that middle 6 months, it was really turbulent. I'd started a psychotherapy diploma just before. So I was able to say, oh, well, this actually looks quite a lot like that psychosis stuff that they were talking about in the diploma. I can't pretend I have any control over the shouting voices in my head. I'm assailed by completely irrational and intense emotions. Sometimes the border between my waking life and my dreaming life is feeling a bit fuzzy. This actually feels like this house of cards is coming down. And then the final 3 months, that storm sort of passed. And I want to say I popped out, but it was sort of this gradual process where that turbulence was still there, but it just receded more and more into the background. And then what had been in the background, which was this kind of oceanic silence, that peace of being in the wilderness and the vastness of that and the poetry and the perfection, that came into the foreground. And that was the most important thing. And that became more what I was interested in and what my mind was able to rest in and who I felt like I was. And for that final 3 months, I was having just incredible experiences of intuition and flow and synchronicity and peace, really, that I started thinking, wow, actually, maybe this is actually what it's supposed to be like as a human being. And then after that, I couldn't wait to get back out and start sharing it with other people. I was like, I want other people to have this too. I'm feeling my only problem is I don't have enough other people out here to share this with.
Yeah, that must have been a powerful feeling coming out, having had such an experience and then needing to go out and share it. I totally resonate with that. And yeah, as you mentioned, in the modern world, we really don't have those spaces or that time to, without distraction, just out in nature, the kind of process that we are exposed to as these peoples living in cities with cultures that have been kind of spread out across the planet with very little story or history behind them, or very little that we can connect. So yeah, that's fascinating. So then from there, did you go back and share like what happened with you sharing those experiences as you got out?
Well, then this whole other chapter of kind of turmoil started, because going back into civilization, then I just sort of encountered, it was almost like, it felt like, I've heard the psychologist R.D. Lang said, you know, when we're born, we're all Stone Age babies, to paraphrase it. Stone Age babies meet the modern world. And it's like we come into the world with expectations, and then those expectations often are dashed. We expect the rhythm of life to be a certain speed, and we expect the stimulus is to be a certain way, and then instead we're met with fluorescent strip lights and talk radio and cars and things. And so it felt like during my year out there, I was digesting all of those unfulfilled expectations, and I was just kind of releasing that. But then going back into the world again, it was like my organism was like, holy shit, hang on, I thought we got over that, we're going back into this again. And I had hit another big wall of grief and overwhelm, and it took me for about 6 months, literally, I was just incapable of doing much at all. And a lot of days I was, I had this by that time, because I'd been sort of releasing so much, I sort of had a bit of faith in that process. I was like, oh, my body knows how to do these emotional chiropractic adjustments. I know how to like let go of stuff. And if I just let go of it, if I just ride out the roller coaster, it seems to be okay in the end. I don't actually die or don't actually go insane. So I tried to give myself over to that process again when I came back again, and I would lock myself in a room, and I would just let my body feel exactly what it was feeling and make the shapes that it wanted to feel and make the noises that it wanted to make, and just trying to release everything, just trying to sort of let go, find my way back to flow again. Because if I didn't do that, I rapidly would get stuck. And then when I got stuck, then things would get really, really painful. So I was just trying to keep flowing my body. And doing that, I was screaming into a pillow so hard, I was often getting burst blood vessels on my face. Oh, and wow. I also realized I wasn't very good at, I'd forgotten how to do small talk too. So I'd be trying to talk to people, have a conversation, and I'd realize a beat or two too late, oh yeah, I should have said something then, or oh yeah, they were waiting for a response, or that would have been a good response. And so a lot of time I think I just seemed like this weirdo who wasn't very talkative and had weird bloodshot things on his face, and I was also completely unsuited for being an employee again after that. So partly the reason I started running programs was because I was like, I can't I'm unemployable now. I've been ruined for employment. Yeah. So I'm gonna have to do stuff on my own terms.
Yeah, you must have. Well, I can resonate with that, like just a big paradigm shift where you can't go back to that old worldview that you may have once had that made something like employment bearable. It's like you just can't see the world in the same way. That's interesting.
I felt like I tasted real freedom, and anything less than that was going to be unbearable. I was like, I'd rather not live then.
Yeah, wow, that's powerful. So then from there, is that like after that 6 month period of processing and really meeting civilization again, is that where from after that you started running programs and kind of wanting to share some of the stuff that you've been learning?
Sort of. I mean, really, like it was the 6 months of really intense shouting into a pillow every day, but really it was about 2 years or maybe even 3 years of learning how to be a modern human again. And then, and working out how I had that young adult problem that I see a lot of young adults having, where kind of what I was talking about earlier, it's like that feeling of, I know I'm not a teenager anymore. I'm not that awkward, gangly teenager who's maybe a bit hostile towards adult life. Now I know I want to try and participate and give something somehow. But to do that in a way that feels like it's in alignment with my deepest values feels like an almost overwhelming task. And I almost feel a bit of despair at times that I'm going to be able to find a niche for myself in this world. And do I even want to? Sort of. And then if I don't immediately, then there's sort of like self-esteem issues. Maybe I'm just a waster. Why have I still not done anything with my life, even though I'm in my mid to late 20s by this time? I see other people going through that phase now, and I really feel like there's more that we could be doing for young adults to help them create lives that are meaningful for them. But my solution was, what's the lowest hanging fruit here? Because, you know, for a long time I was thinking, oh, I need to create something. I need to create a school or an institute or a new modality or something, or I need to write a book. And in the end, what I came to was, is also big, is also overwhelming and scary. I'll just do what's the easiest thing right now? What's the lowest hanging fruit that I can do now? The most reward for the least effort. And that happened to be taking kids out into the bush and just hanging out with them and seeing what happened and just seeing what adventures we could make. Because of my experience as a staff member for the forest school camps, that was well within my comfort zone. And it started out with just friends' kids. It's just, hey, I'll take them on adventure and show them some stuff. And luckily enough, I had friends who were willing to entrust their kids to me. And then it kind of grew from there. We had a daughter who died of cancer at 3. And after that, there was a time when the business was just starting to pick up then. And then after that, I said, maybe I can't work with kids after all, after this. But if I am, then it's going to look like this. I'm not going to do it any other way than what feels right for me. And that was really when we started making those camps. I said, well, now I need the parents to come along and look after their kids. I'm not going to do childcare. And I don't want to do it just for a day at a time. I want to have a good week. Let's have a week together. But parents come too. I'll take the kids for a bit and then I'll hand them back over again when I'm tired. And that's how it will work. And then it's evolved. And so, now it's evolved into 120 people, a team of 25, 30 mentors, all kinds of different sort of layers in our culture, parent circles and mentor circles. And, but it started out with just me asking what just really feels the most juicy and that has the least amount of should in it.
Yeah, I love it. That's great. And can you maybe describe those camps a little bit more, like how long they go for? What's the kind of vibe you're trying to create with them? What's the, what does it look like for participants?
So it's wild camping. And that means that there's not much infrastructure. There isn't running water. There's just a river. There's compost toilets and it's on the edge of a wilderness area. And everything that we need, we just bring with us. We turn up to an empty field at the edge of wilderness. And it's cool because it means that anyone who's willing to put themselves in that situation is kind of already our people. It's quite self-selecting. And so parents will turn up and we spend 5 days together. And in the morning, the first half of the day, Mia and the mentors will take the kids away and we split them into different age groups. And we have lots of mini tribes. We have a secret little primitive camp that we take the kids to and have adventures. And we're basically just saying, we're asking, how can we be more at home in the bush? What kind of skills and awareness do we need to be more at home in the bush? Let's explore that together. And the job of the mentors isn't really to impart specific skills, although they do that. It's mostly child-led, curiosity-led, and peer-led. And then in the afternoons, we just kind of hang out together. There's one day where we have a big kind of fiesta, a big like dance and drumming and dress ups thing. And in the evenings, we tell stories around in the longhouse and have music and eat dinner together. It's very simple in one sense. You know, there's not much really that happens, but it's the simplicity of humans coming together with some shared values, some shared stories, and then deepening into a way of being with each other that just feels so natural to everyone. We get people, you know, it's their first time, but they express in different ways this kind of feeling of, I think I've been looking for this, or oh, this actually is who I am, or what it feels like to be a human, and I didn't know this was possible, or I had an inkling it was possible. But this is what I prefer.
Yeah, that's great. And I love that you create those experiences and give people the opportunity to have a bit of a taste of what it is to be a human being in this crazy world where it seems like it's almost illegal to be human.
Yeah, it is in lots of ways. Hey,
That's great. So I'd like to get maybe a little bit of your why and what inspires you to do these things, and why do you think like this concept of rewilding and getting back in touch with nature is so important to you personally and just for people listening?
Well, I mean, to me, it boils down to that, what we've just been talking about, that feeling of being human. And I like that phrase, Napoleon Hill's phrase, enlightened self-interest. I mean, really, that's why I do it. I think it's enlightened self-interest. It's self-interest in the sense that it just feels good for me. It feels good for me to do these things, and it feels good to share them. It feels good to be on this journey of discovery with other human beings who also are on that journey. And I think that often when there's like more loftier ideas tacked onto that, when I'm sort of trying to make it more than just what feels good to be the most natural human and most empowered and fully realized human that I can be, then it's easy for things to get a bit complicated, or like more structures to come along. I think I have to start an institute, or I think I have to write down a really detailed curriculum, or I've got to interface with the school systems or whatever. I think it's necessary that we do all those things. But if we're doing it from the position of we need to change the world because the world is broken, then there's not only sort of a negativity to that, there's also a kind of arrogance too, that the idea that the world is broken. I actually personally don't think it's broken at all. I think that we've been on this experiment. You know, humans about 10,000 years ago embarked on an experiment. Some humans in the Fertile Crescent said, hey, what would it be like if instead of living according to the rhythms of nature, we fenced off a bunch of land and we went into what Daniel Quinn calls totalitarian agriculture? What if we try that? Maybe we'll never have to worry about famine again. Maybe we'll be able to live like kings. And then, as you probably know, the archaeological record shows that no one got to live like kings. And in fact, all kinds of things happened to those humans who switched over to agriculture, and life got really hard, and they had much less diversity in their diet, and the average height dropped because they were so malnourished and overworked by trying to enforce their will upon nature. But we stuck with it because the vision was so powerful. The vision was no more scarcity and safety and plenty for everyone. And I think now we're in a position where we can say, okay, the data is coming in from that experiment. We're realizing the cost of what happens when we try to control nature and make it more efficient and more organized and bend it to our will. And there's all kinds of amazing, fantastic things that we've discovered from this experiment. There's all kinds of things I wouldn't want to give up and I really cherish. I love supermarkets are amazing, and libraries and museums and incredible culture and beautiful things. And we're also, there's enough information now from going down this path to say, and there's also incredible loss and incredible scarcity of another kind that we encounter when we cut ourselves off from nature and from each other, and that the cost, maybe the cost of convenience and efficiency at all costs and progress and profit at all costs, maybe that those costs are too high, and actually it's time for the balance to swing back a little bit in the other way, which doesn't mean that we all go anarcho-primitivist necessarily, but that we just recognize our greater context, we recognize who and what we actually are, and how we can best be the organisms that we are. I think that's what we're kind of realizing from this experiment.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that
idea. And people...
Sorry, you go.
Oh, I'm just going to say, like, people are free to participate in the rewilding movement or not. Like, it doesn't really matter. I think that it's really important for us to feel like maybe some people are here to experience being really good at investment banking. Maybe some people are just really here to get really good at making movies or to do whatever it is that they want to do. But the movement is going to be back towards nature. The movement is going to be back towards balance. And you can participate in that or not. You're really free to do that. I think it's important that we acknowledge that.
Yeah, I love that message. I totally agree with all that you say in that. And I think it's really important. Keep rewilding as a choice, and just something that, yeah, and look at agriculture and all of that as an experiment, because really our ancestors were acting according to nature, in the sense that, you know, they were seeking
absolutely
the same things that we are, just they were doing it a different way, and they were doing possibly a misinformed position, but it's not good or bad, it just is.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit about rapport-based relating, what that is and why you do that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, part of the revelation for me in the early days on those forest school camps was realizing, wow, the way that these adults are interacting with me and with the other kids is really different to how I experience at home and at school. And at home and at school, there's often, actually, if I think about it, quite a lot of shame involved. There's quite a lot of force involved, like, no, you'll do it now because I told you to. Okay, so stop doing that and go and do it. And then on the forest school camps, there was this feeling. It was weird at first. It was like, all of these adults are just assuming goodwill. They're just assuming that I want to help. They're assuming that if I didn't do something right away or the right way, they're assuming that there was a good reason for that. And they're happy to discover what that reason is and have conversations about it. And the feeling was so strong for me that it sort of just became a part of my deepest values. It's okay, yeah, this is what I like. This is how I like to interact with other humans. This is how I think that humans and kids can interact in a way where there's this implicit feeling that we're actually equals, and really let's just talk about how we can all get our needs met. And when I came to Australia and I was working in outdoor education for a bit, I was in organizations that were saying that they were up for that. They were saying, we want to empower kids, we want to and help foster resiliency and promote equality. But then what was actually happening was just more shouting and shaming when it got down to it. There was like a little bit more sort of, there was like lip service to something else, but some really unhealthy power structures that were going on, sort of power dynamics. And I really think that they are related to civilization. The civilization is based on the conquest of other cultures, and to do that we had to tell our soldiers or the settlers who are going to go out, I'm talking as an English person now, you know, but in the English Empire, the British Empire, they had to convince the working classes that they were going to send out to the rest of the world to try and paint the world pink, like it was when the British Empire was at its peak, and say, hey, you're superior. So we got to beat some sense into these savages and tell them how to live properly, because right now they're living miserable lives. And I think that a similar sort of feeling creeps into our dynamics at work and in the household and in parenting as well, where we all kind of grew up with a little bit of that, a little bit of shouting and shaming, a little bit of, it doesn't matter what you think right now, what you feel, there's an agenda here. We need to get with the schedule. It's school time or it's dinner time. So stop doing whatever you think is important and get with the program. So when I got clear about this and we started running my own programs, I said it's important for us to be able to articulate what our alternative vision is. And so it's rather than using shouting and shaming, it's appealing to our connection, our rapport. And so rather than saying you need to do this because I say so or because I'm going to get unpleasant if you don't, it's appealing to our connection and saying, hey, I could really do with a hand with this. Would you be up for giving me a hand? And then actually listening to what the answer is rather than just guilt tripping the other person until they say yes. And so that's what rapport-based relating is. It's interactions, it's relating based on connection rather than shouting and shaming, rather than violence or hierarchy. And for me, it's just the rewilding of human culture. It's the rewilding of our interpersonal interactions. It's something that I've always been really passionate about. I've got notebooks filled with you know thoughts that come into my head on this subject, and most of my work as a psychotherapist now is doing coaching work with parents, most of whom are parents who've come on the camp, and they say, we love that kind of feeling, that social feeling that we had on the camps, that air of acceptance and equality and cooperation, and we'd like to, when we got back to our houses, that kind of fell apart a little bit. I don't know what went on there, but I'd like to bring some more of that back into our daily lives. Can you help me with that, please? So that's a lot of what I do.
Yeah, and you offer coaching, and do you do workshops on that as well?
Yeah, I do workshops on that, and phone sessions. Mostly phone sessions because I'm on the road so much, and half of that is how do we do connection? How do we actually build connection? And this idea that there are, maybe we can think about it as there are ropes of connection between us, and those ropes of connection can be more or less strong. And if we don't tend those ropes of connection, they can get a bit tattered. So how do we tend them? How do we make good, strong connections with each other and with ourselves? Because that's the key thing, really, is when parents start to get vicious and they behave in ways with their kids or with their partners that they feel that they regret afterwards, it's always because, well, first of all, I fell out of connection with myself. It's like we have a sphere of acceptance and love, and sometimes that sphere of acceptance and love shrinks so small that now I'm not standing in it. And now it doesn't matter what anyone thinks or feels. We just need to get with the program. I've got to push through the natural instincts or rhythms of my body. I got to sort of do a violence to myself in order to make certain things happen. If I'm in that state, it's just a matter of time before I start using force and violence with other people as well. And so half of the rapport-based relating training is about how do we make good connections, and the other half is about the kind of craft of interactions. How do we resolve conflicts well? How do we communicate well? How do we meet the other person where they're at? And the kind of emotional kung fu of how can I dodge the energetic spears that they're throwing at me, and how can I do sort of an Aikido with that attack that they've just offered me?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it must be quite an art, and something that we've lost a lot of, as you say. Like it's like the rewilding of the way that we relate to people, because it seems like something that needs to be quite intentional. And it is there's quite an art to it. But as you say, like we have this kind of worldview of conquest, especially when we're communicating, it seems, or a lot of people do, and it must be quite hard to come back to a more natural way of communicating.
Absolutely, it is hard. Yeah, no, it is really hard. And I'm someone who's like been obsessed with this and held this as a strong value for years, for most of my life, really. I remember as a kid thinking, you parents don't know how to talk to me properly. When I'm an adult, I'm going to write a book about it so everyone knows how to talk to their kids properly. And I still now as an adult fall into those traps and find myself interacting at times with my daughter and my wife and in ways where after I'm like, oh God, I went fully into the crazy then. I got lost in the crazy. So it's hard, but it's also, I think, right at the coalface of cultural repair. It's right at the coalface of the kinds of changes that we need to have happen in order for us to really fulfill our potential as humans. And so I just think it's a really worthwhile battle, and I'm definitely don't present myself as a master of it, but I do feel strongly about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. That's great, man. Is there anything you wanted to touch on or talk about as we start to wrap this up? Is there any more points that you wanted to like really bring to the forefront of people's minds in this conversation?
Thanks. I don't think so. I think, well, maybe the central one is, for me, the heart of rewilding is moving away from external authority, or from being sort of guided by or driven by external authority, to being led through my life by internal authority. In other words, the things that I love and the things that I'm hungry for and my instincts and my feelings about things. And I think that sometimes when people approach rewilding, there's a kind of a should behind it, or there's a fear behind it. There's a kind of an external drive behind it. You know, the really worthwhile people do it the wild way, or they do it organic, or they do it biodynamic, or whatever. And I think if it's not actually what you love, it's not what you feel really drawn to because it just feels so good inside of you, then I would say don't bother. I would say just, you know, find whatever it is you really love. And to me, that's the most wild thing. That's the most that's the most pure form of rewilding. Even if what you love is computer programming or being a car mechanic, what really brings you joy and sets you on fire, that's bringing you into your most powerful and actualized and free self. And anything else is just, it's not that far away from that reality where we start to feel like livestock being driven along by someone else's schedule.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And
And when we, if someone was to look at rewilding from a should, that would be like the opposite of rewilding in a way, because it's like, it still comes from that domesticated mindset of like, oh, I should do this, or I should fence myself into a certain thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, sometimes maybe we start off as a should, but if still years into it, I'm still feeling like, I'm feeling like I should know how to light a Bodrill fire. I should know hunting. But what I actually really genuinely love is illustrating kids' books or something like that. I'm like, please, brother, sister, do yourself and the whole world a favor and go for what you're actually here for on this earth for, what the thing that actually sets you on fire.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great message, man. Mm. Well, thank you so much for sharing in your time. How can people connect with you and find out more about what you're doing?
The website Blue Gum Bushcraft is probably the easiest way. It's bluegumbushcraft.com.au. There's a page on that website about rapport-based relating and all of the camps we run, the men's survival retreats that we run, the bush school programs, and you can contact me personally through that website too if you're interested in getting in touch.
Awesome, that's great. Can you quickly describe the men's survival camps, because that sounds epic.
Oh yeah. So that's their weekend trips is sort of like a nice little bite-sized intense rewilding experience where we go out with just wearing shorts, no t-shirt, no shoes, just shorts and a woolen blanket. And then one survival item each. So it might be a knife, it might be a pot to boil water in, but each of us in the group will carry one and be the keeper of that survival item. And then we just go out and we see how whether it's possible for us to be at home in the wild. And magically, somehow it always is. And we do that in a way where, and can we do that also in a way where we're creating a feeling of brotherhood, of emotional safety. We'll do check-in circles and the sort of more of the, some of the more traditional stuff of men's business where we talk, but mostly it's this idea of actually to be men and really feel like empowered men. It's not enough just to sit in a circle and talk. There are skills that we need as men in order to feel truly safe in the world and truly able to protect and provide for our families and our tribes. And so let's have a look at what some of those might be, as well as heartfelt and real sharing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. And I'll link up for anyone listening in the show notes to the website, Blue Gum Bushcraft, so people can connect with you. That's, yeah, thank you so much, Lee. I really appreciate your time and coming on and sharing everything.
My absolute pleasure, Jake. Yeah, thanks. It's really, really cool work that you're doing. I look forward to hearing the episodes that are about to come out.
Sweet. So thank you guys so much for tuning in to this episode. If you want to connect with Lee, then I put all the links to connect with him down in the show notes. If you liked and got value out of this episode, then please take a screenshot and share it on social media, tag myself, and let me know some of your key takeaways. And if you're getting value out of this podcast in general, then let me know by leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you get your podcasts on, and also subscribe if you haven't done that already. It really helps with getting the show out to more people. So thanks again, guys, for listening in. I hope you got value out of this, and if you did, then it would be great if you could repay some of the value that I'm putting out there by helping me share this message by doing those things that I just mentioned. So thanks again, and I will catch you on the next episode of Move Wild Podcast.